And welcome. Thank you for being here. First Sunday program of 2023. So happy new year to everyone. My name is Jeremy Druin, and I head up the library's special collections. Our research room is located right across the hall. So if you've never visited before, feel free to drop by following the program. I have the pleasure of introducing our speaker this afternoon, LaDean Morton. LaDean is a longtime friend, supporter, and user of the library and special collections. And we are thrilled to have her back as a speaker. Morton grew up in Lawrence, Kansas and attended KU, earning a master's degree in public administration. She has called Kansas City home for the last 40 years. Over that time, she's developed a passion for preserving and promoting our city's history, specifically the history of its development and communities. Morton has authored books on the iconic Brookside, Waldo, and Country Club District neighborhoods, the latter of which received a preservation award from the Historic Kansas City Foundation. Additionally, her historical novel, What Lies West, was a 2009 finalist for the Willa Cather Literary Award presented by the Women Writing the West Association. Morton continues to publish fascinating stories of Kansas City's past on her blog, which is aptly called Kansas City Backstories. Her KC 1900 series explores a pivotal event in our city's history, a devastating fire that destroyed the new convention hall a mere 3 months before the 1900 Democratic National Convention was to be held there. She's here to explain how civic leaders rallied to get a new hall built and keep the convention in Kansas City. Please join me in welcoming to the library, LaDean Morton.
Thank you. First of all, can everybody hear me? Yes? Okay, good. Thank you for coming. You don't know how Jeremy and I sweated this out, thinking that the Chiefs game would be going on right now. So I'm sorry for the reason, but I'm really glad it turned out the way that it did. As Jeremy told you, the Kansas City Convention Hall fire is a pivotal point in Kansas City history, but not a well-known. I certainly wasn't a secret. I didn't discover it. But as I was researching some of the other things that he mentioned, I kept kind of bumping into it. And it was fascinating, as he told you. I'll expand that basic story just a bit. This convention hall, which you see here, was built in 1899, opened in February of 1899, I should tell you right up front, it sat where today Barney Atlas Plaza sits. So that should orient you a little bit. If that doesn't, we'll get back to that in a bit. So it opened in February of 1899, and 14 months later, after a very lively life, on April 4th to 1900, it burned to the ground in about less than an hour. And as he mentioned, if that wasn't devastating enough, Kansas City had put an awful lot of its eggs in the basket of having the Democratic Convention come here auspiciously on July 4th, 1900. Now, that's a fascinating story in and of itself, but I was also interested in a whole lot of other dimensions. As he mentioned, I'm interested in community and economic development, so I really wanted to know what role this convention hall played in all of that. Who were the people who put this together? Because this is still a pretty early point in Kansas City's development. What were they trying to accomplish? What the heck was up with the fire? You know, what caused it and all those things. And then on the backside, how did it all turn out? Pardon me just a second. And so when COVID hit, I've been putting these little pieces of paper in folders, and then the folders became boxes, and then boxes became the corner of my office and the whole nine yards that usually happens. And I thought, I'm just not up for another book, and frankly, I'm not sure this would have sustained a whole book. But it was a perfect thing for my Casey Backstories blog, which I'd like to sort of go follow. So going through that, through all the information I had about, it ended up with about 19 posts, individual stories. And I'm not going to give you all 19 of them, but I did try and pick out some that filled out the story of the convention hall fire, but also maybe tells you a little something about Kansas City at that period that you may not know. I didn't know. That doesn't mean you don't know, but still in all, I think it's worth going back over. All right, let's see if technology stays with us. Okay. So my first question to myself was, who were these guys? And frankly, let's just be honest right up front, it was guys. I would love to tell you I found a secret story of a woman who made this all happen, but I did not. That's okay. I need to go no further back than the Hannibal Bridge. Now, that is a pretty well-known story, but I want you to think about it this way. Kansas City did a remarkable job of getting them to build the bridge here. It was the first bridge to cross the Mississippi, railroad bridge to cross the Missouri River. I know, I caught myself there. And so that was its big significance. And the political machinations of the people in Kansas City made that possible. But what made it happen at all was the interest and the influence and the wealth of everyone east of us who had already developed an industrial economy. So the railroads, the steel makers, anybody who manufactured anything, anybody who processed anything, looked to this area and saw this bridge as, the picture in the back says, a gateway to the west. To hell with St. Louis, this was the gateway to the West. These were not the first people to do this, and I thought that was an important thing to keep in mind, because we tend to think of, oh, all of our great names that were Kansas City, the pioneers of Kansas City, all those people came from somewhere else, and they all came here to speculate. The difference is that these people were speculating at a whole nother level. They weren't coming to carve a niche out for themselves in the West and be traders and whatnot. No, they were full-fledged industries and corporations who were coming to see what the opportunities were in Kansas City. I don't usually use notes, but it's been so long since I've done one of these, I figured I'd better be careful. So what they brought, first and foremost, was infrastructure. And I think this picture pretty much sums it up. They brought the railroad, so they brought the railroad yard. They brought the train station. They brought the stockyards. They didn't literally bring them. They brought the money for them, for the warehousing, for the grain elevators, everything, up to and including the significant extensions of the interurban railway system in Kansas City, which you see here. Virtually every name behind those was someone who came across the Missouri River on that bridge. In addition to the industrial side, what naturally follows from that is, of course, is the commercial side. Just for your sense of direction, this is as if you're standing on Walnut looking west up 12th Street, which was only coincidental to the fact that right up at the top of that hill is where the new convention center is going to be. But once you have all this industry, of course, you have the department stores, you have the cigar stores. My God, I never knew there were that many cigar stores in the world at any one time. But doctors and lawyers and all kinds of commerce. You also, with all of that, became the social structure of Kansas City started to change. And I certainly want to emphasize the fact that Kansas City wasn't alone in this. This was happening to all the cities that are sort of more or less parallel with us on the latitude as the country moved west, save San Francisco, of course. With them, one of the things they brought was the idea of clubs, like country clubs. This was a period when the Kansas City Country Club was brand new. The Kansas City Club, the University Club, the Prospect Club. And in this particular case, something called the Commercial Club. Now, commercial clubs were not just here, they were all over, and generally speaking, they were the precursors to chambers of commerce. And why that's relevant is that, unlike a lot of the other clubs, which were both social and culturally minded, the commercial club was commercially oriented. They got involved immediately in a city that was not yet of the size or sophistication to take on large projects. Kansas City at this point was mostly about putting together laws and regulations, making sure we had fire departments and police departments. But there was no land use, no zoning, no energy for forward thinking on things like a convention hall. When the commercial club, let me show you a picture of these guys. Here they are getting on a streetcar as part of a opening ceremony sort of event for the Democratic National Convention. And in their early days, even they weren't as forward-thinking as they became. They mostly focused on promoting Kansas City at a regional level. So they would do things like the expositions. If you've ever seen the picture of the sort of Kansas City version of the Crystal Palace, where you'd show what Kansas City has to offer in terms of industrial and commercial capacity, that sort of thing. But they were also involved in the parks plan, in the waterworks, building the first waterworks, the library system, training center, that was it. They worked on manual training centers. All these things were good for Kansas City, but they were obviously also really good for the businesses. But shortly before the convention hall subject comes up, they begin to shift their focus. And I think it's best displayed in this brochure that they did in anticipation of the Democratic Convention. Here we go. Imperial Kansas City is a long way from making Kansas City a good place in which to live. Far more aspirational. Everything about this just screams this to me, where it says the ideal location for assembling of conventions, designed to rank among the greatest commercial centers of the world. They prominently displayed the railroads and the warehouses and all that they brought, and labeled that her wonderful growth and resources. But nothing is more telling and more specifically accurate than where it says in little, relatively unassuming type, the distributing point for the West and the South. That's really what this was all about. Now, they started talking about this well before there was a convention hall, probably around, 1893 or so. They would talk about it internally as part of a lot of things they talked about. But one of the things I'm not going to go into a lot of depth, but I do have to mention, is and this will be a surprise to no one who knows Kansas City, the very important role that the Kansas City Star and William Rockwell Nelson played in all of this. For research purposes, I laid out all the articles that were in the Star over this period because I simply wanted to make sure I wasn't missing any of the events. And what I saw when I got done with that was a masterclass in how a newspaper can take its journalistic side and its editorial side and slowly and carefully and thoughtfully, I must say, over the years, direct everybody into thinking this is a wonderful idea. In this case, it probably was a wonderful idea. In other times, maybe not so much. But I do know enough about Nelson to know that whatever aggrandizement it gave him, at the center of all this was always a sense of what will make Kansas City grow, because that overall was the best thing for him. So he played a very important role in all of this in a lot of subtle ways, not the least of which was underscoring to the public that the commercial club should be the one to handle this project. They'd done that on a smaller scale, but this time they were going to take over the whole project. Here's the announcement of the design competition a little later in the process, but the commercial club's job was to organize this project, because at this point it's just rhetoric and good ideas, right? And I know from personal experience that is no small feat. It's one thing to talk about, let's build an airport, and it's a whole other thing to sit down and actually figure out the logistics. That was going to be their job. I thought that's quite overwhelming to me, but as I learned, not so much. You know, one part usually is financing. They really came in with all the financing they need, and what wasn't committed to the project when they got started, they knew they could get once the project had more definition. So that wasn't an issue. Even so, they went out with a public campaign because they understood how important it would be to have the public's support for this. So by the time they were done through this whole thing, everybody in Kansas City, if at all possible, was wearing a button supporting this, had given their pennies, their nickels, their dimes to this project. They kept that money in a sort of contingency fund. So that's a hard part that they had. Usually there's a political opposition to things like this. Again, as I told you before, Kansas City had other fish to fry in terms of getting up to speed, so that really wasn't there. And so the only thing they had to worry about to begin with was the design competition. Now this design was done by a young architect named Frederick Hill. He ultimately won the competition. He was up against some more noted architects in Kansas City by the names of like Van Brunt. There are actually two unrelated Van Brunts, Henry and Adrian's. Frederick Gunn, Charles Schaefer, Louis Curtis were all bidding on this project. And call me crazy, but I'm not convinced that it's a coincidence that Frederick Hill, who got the job, also just happened to be the man who designed Oak Hall for William Rockwell Nelson. Still in all, you know, it was more or less modeled after Madison Square Garden, which was built just before our convention hall, which made it just a pretty serviceable building. No one was looking for too much architectural design in this project. Now, there were not a lot of, I did not find a lot of pictures of this hall, the first one, but I was lucky enough to stumble upon some floor plans that were in an old engineering journal. And I know that they're fuzzy and hard to read. They were not much clearer in the journal that I found, but it gives you a sense of what the building was like. Now, first, let me just orient you. To your left is north and to your right is south. So this is 12th Street and 13th Street, respectively. At the top on the east is Wyandotte, and on the bottom is Central, just so you have that in your mind. This was one configuration, this is the basement, rather, where the floor was dirt, because this is where if they had rodeos or livestock shows or horse shows, those hatch marks at the top were stalls for the livestock. Basically, other mechanical and functional rooms down at the bottom. There's that long horizontal piece about a third up is a firing range, and at the end was an armory. But the most important thing for this floor is that you know that in this bottom left corner is where the boiler, the coal room, and the electrical wiring was housed. Okay, so now this is the main floor in one configuration in the arena setting. In that center, again, it could be dirt if it was going to be a rodeo, or they had a removable floor in case it was going to be dancing or a convention. The ring around the outer with all the small boxes is in fact the boxes, the seating boxes, and some other storage places down toward the bottom. This is what that would have looked like. Now, this is actually of the second hall, but it shows the band shell down in the north end. The other way to configure that main hall is like this, and this is how it would have been for the convention. Wall-to-wall seating. Then there was a little bit on the next floor of these, it's a banquet hall, a ladies' hall, and I cannot remember what the other space is, but smaller halls. And right outside of this was probably the closest thing to an architectural embellishment as the hall had. This was the roof garden, and it was an open air area that ran the perimeter of the hall. It's under construction here, and the only thing that's really missing is between the columns, the big spaces of the columns, there were screens to buffet the elements a little bit, I guess. This one's looking south to the Presbyterian Church right there, but I just think that would have been a beautiful feature. Let me jump ahead here a little bit. Ah, so that was the hall that they built. Came time for booking events once they got started on that, and they booked a lot of events. They had a lot of things that happened in that first 14 months. But for the opening night, before the hall was even really much under construction, they were contacted by John Philip Sousa. He wanted to be the opening night act, if you will. And what he wanted, the reason he wanted it was he was looking for a showcase. Now, he was no longer with the Marine Band. He had his own band, and he wanted people to book them as a dance band. So he wanted to use this as a place. And boy, Kansas City glommed onto that. They had all kinds of promotions, making a big deal out of the fact the first time ever in the history of the world, John Philip Sousa was going to be having a dance band. Okay, that gives you sort of a run up to the hall. Now we're going to talk about the fire. And again, just to orient you, I stole this from a city website where they were talking about Barney Ellis Plaza. So the Barney Ellis Plaza part was already done for me, but I highlighted where the main streets were to orient you. 12th and 13th on the north and south ends. Main Street over there, of course, is Kansas City's Main Street. Central and Wyandotte on either side of the convention hall, and Broadway as the other main commercial corridor in downtown Kansas City at the time. And I left these flags that the city had put up for whatever reason to remind me and you how long this spot has been the convention identity of Kansas City. There were hotels then where there are hotels now. There were ancillary theaters and other entertainments where they are now. So there's pretty strong tradition. In jumping ahead quite a bit, in the 30s, when they tore down the replacement hall, is when they built Municipal Auditorium to take that place. When that would no longer suffice, they built what's labeled as the Kansas City Convention Hall, but what we know as Bartle Hall. So this has really been the hub of Kansas City's convention life for a long, long time. Now to the fire. Let me orient you with what the world looked like back then. On the southwest corner of the convention hall across 13th Street was Second Presbyterian Church. This is the same Second Pres that sits today at 55th and Oak. They had been downtown for a long time and had another location, and for reasons I can't remember, had rebuilt here. Likewise, Lathrop School. The Lathrop School had been downtown for a very long time. And in the 1880s, I'm sorry, I don't remember the exact year, when that tornado came through downtown, some of you may recall that the Lathrop School bell tower was knocked into the school by that tornado and killed several children. So, ironically or weirdly or whatever, when they rebuilt, they built here. The Williamson block, the name Williamson simply refers to the plat name of that area. It was a row of six conjoined boarding houses. And then down here is a little strip of mixed use that was facing Broadway. And I'll talk a little bit more about what was there. But these are the areas that sustained significant damage, so I wanted to make sure you had those landmarks in mind. Now, as to the timeline, right before the fire was noticed, it was the noon hour. Most everybody had cleared out, although it was a building that people seemed to walk in and out of a lot, being a public building. There were three janitors on site having their lunch, and otherwise nothing was going on. In retrospect, they figured that the fire started about 12:45, but it wasn't noticed for 15 minutes. At 1 o'clock, a gentleman walking into the Isles drugstore, which was at the north end of this mixed-use stripe, saw the smoke coming out of the hall, went inside the drugstore, and made the first call. At about the same time, the kids from the Lathrop School, the bell had rung, and they were coming back into the building when the principal looked out his window and saw the smoke, but he also saw the filtering ash. And he ran outside and got all the kids to go out the back. And everybody was saved. In fact, no one was killed or hurt that I know of in any of this. But it did make a point of saying in the paper that the pupils nearly all lost their school books. So that seems to be the main casualty of that particular part of the fire. The Kansas City Fire Department headquarters was in the blocks just north of here. So at 1:05, they received the first call, and the assistant chief was on the first team, but before they left, he walked outside and saw the billowing smoke and called a second alarm. So almost all the fire engines in Kansas City started heading for this site. Of course, keep in mind, they are horse-drawn wagons, so as fast as they were going, and they were quite skilled, they still weren't going to get there very fast. Now, I don't have really any pictures of the fire, so I thought what I would do is show you sort of the damage as I tell you about what happens in sequence here. So this is the interior of the hall. At 1:10, the first reporters showed up on the scene. One of them reported, or remembered in a retrospect 50 years later, by the time I reached 12th Street, flames were bursting out of the roof of the hall. It soon became plain that there was not a chance of saving any part of the building. Exposition buildings of this type had in them enough wood to create such terrific heat that the thousands of panes of glass melted to a liquid and the steel girders twisted like strips of tin. Here you're looking at people starting to come the next day and look at the building. But since this is concerns the onlookers coming up to the site. When the chief talked about it afterward, the assistant chief, he said, "When we reached the hall, the heat was so terrific that we never got inside the building. We never got nearer than across the street. The men dragged one line of hose across 13th Street, but the heat drove them away. And before the water could be turned on or the hose dragged back, the hose was burned to pieces." Also, another reporter was making his way to the scene, and he happened to pass the doors of the Kansas City the Kansas City Club, which was also in that area north of the convention hall. And he saw the members standing out on the sidewalk collecting money, and he asked them what they were doing, and they said, "Well, we're collecting money to rebuild the convention hall." It had not yet burned to the ground, and yet the collection had started already. This is the interior. This is the office area. And about 1:30, a janitor, one of the janitors that had been having lunch there, broke back into the building and then broke into the office to collect whatever papers he could find, ledgers and photographs and all those things. And when I went to research this at the State Historical Society, some of the pages that I found and pictures I found were burned on the edges. I don't know for a fact, but it almost seems inevitable to me that some of that would have happened with this. By 1:45, the hall was a complete loss. And the final touch was that as the south end, the entrance, the stone started caving down on 13th Street. At the same time, the steeple at the Second Presbyterian Church collapsed right on top of it. But that was just the hall. Now you're looking at the inside, you're looking at the north end of the building, and behind that is that Williamson block, the boarding house, as I mentioned, completely burned out. It was a total loss. Again, they had plenty of time to get the residents out because the pattern of burning from the hull was from the northwest corner to the south, but the southwest wind kept blowing ash back, and so that's why a lot of these peripheral places caught on fire. Here you're looking through the building from the east side, through the debris, across to the Lathrop School, and behind that row of mixed use. In this block, the mixed use block, there were 6 private homes, a boarding house, a bookstore, a tailor shop, a meat market, the Hotel Cunningham, and ISIL's drugstore, where the first call came. All of those buildings were damaged beyond repair. And finally, the next day, this panorama gives you just sort of an overall shot of the devastation. The fact that you can stand here at what would be approximately, 14th Street, and you can look virtually all the way up to 12th and Broadway without complete interruption. Presbyterian Church, Lathrop School, Williams Block, and in the center, of course, the convention hall. By 3:30, this picture isn't, but at the time it was declared all over, it was 2:30. By 3:30, folks were all back at the commercial club, starting to do all the things they needed to do to rebuild it. Now, this is a drawing from the Star that gives you at least some sense of what the fire looked like. The cause. Lots of speculation years after as to what the cause was. I won't add to that speculation, but I'll tell you what was the best evidence I saw of the true crime, or true problem. There was, first of all, it was immediately declared an accident. That certainly facilitated moving forward. There were 3,200 arc lamps in this building. Now, I don't know, I wasn't terribly familiar with arc lamps, but of the time, they were the best way to put a lot of light in a big space like a convention hall. And they generated a lot of heat, individually, 30 times 3,200. There was a gentleman who worked for the organization that advises all insurance underwriters. And they had 25 insurance underwriters covering the damage on this building before it was built. He came in and he said the wiring was insufficient to the purpose, but it fit the Kansas City regulations as to what the wiring should be, but it far missed what current industry standards were. So there was mistakes made, but there was really nobody at fault, per se. So that's what seems to be the best explanation for the cause. Now, my next question was, how did they manage to do this in 3 months? And again, when I started parsing it out, it really wasn't as hard to imagine as I thought. Excuse me, just a second. Like I said, there were no questions about liability, so that there was no impediment there. Once you clean up the site, there was virtually no site preparation. They already had a plan that, except for that little niggling wiring thing, worked very well to the purpose of the building. And in terms of getting their supplies, which originally had taken months and months and months, with a national spotlight on this event because of the Democratic Convention, they had no problem getting vendors to say, sure, we'll move you up in line. Everybody wanted to seem like they were supportive of this effort. They certainly didn't want to seem unsupportive of the effort. So the original design was used with a couple of modifications. First of all, they realized they didn't have to build back everything for the Democratic Convention. So with a lot of the stuff in the basement, et cetera, they didn't bother finishing that up. They just did what they had to do to get the convention going. Second of all, I know they did some fire resistance work. I don't know exactly what that is, but I do know that by closing in that roof garden, that lovely roof garden, that would have certainly been something that would help. And I'm betting money that they did a whole new wiring scheme on it as well. Okay, now the convention itself really doesn't have a lot to do with Kansas City. I mean, you know, it's a national convention. But for the sake of historical record, I will share with you a few things. First of all, this was the second contest that would be the second contest between William Jennings Bryan and William McKinley. 1896 was the election that was the whole cross of gold, bimetal controversy. It was the third time William Jennings Bryan had run for president, and he was still plying this cross of gold stuff, but nobody else cared about it. The Democrats said, this is the best we got, we're gonna run him again, and of course, McKinley beat him hands down. Even that, though, was not consequential, because a couple of months after McKinley was elected, he was assassinated, and Teddy Roosevelt became president, and it was a whole different ballgame. There is one local connection to this, and that is Harry Truman. There's a story that says, in fact, there's a monograph that you can see on the Truman Library site that says Harry Truman served as a page at this convention when he was 15 years old. And I find that completely plausible. But in fairness, when I found that out, I contacted the Truman Library and I said, I would love to know the original source material for this so that I can expand on it. And after a couple of switching to different offices, I found somebody who was good enough to be candid and said, well, that piece was written by a volunteer several years ago. We don't remember who, and we have no idea where she found the information. So I add that so as if you go out into the world and share these fun facts, you know, you'll know when you're standing on solid ground and not on solid ground, okay? All right, this is, on the right you see a picture. All these illustrations are from the Kansas City Star. This is men and reporters hanging around in the lobby of the Midland Hotel. This probably is a fanciful drawing. You know, this was the period of the big hats, where women had birds and things on their hat. And I think that some star illustrator simply concocted this as, you know, conventions coming, etc. But I can't swear to you that that hat didn't exist at one time. I thought those would be good things to have up while I share something with you. I did look at how Kansas City, how its reputation was enhanced, or if it was. And it was. And when I looked through national newspapers, there was always glowing reports about the city, and everybody loved it, and everything went fine. Kansas City got everything it wanted out of this experience. But inevitably, there were also little side stories. So I went to the New York Times, the New York Tribune, and the New York Sun, and read some of their lesser wire stories. And I pulled out a couple, four here to share with you that are interesting in one way or another. Kansas City expects a lot of women at this convention. Many delegates and leaders have sent word that they intend to bring their wives, and the Kansas City women have made up their minds to give them a good time. The Athenaeum of Kansas City will throw open its house at 9th and Locust, and it has invited all the women's clubs of the city to help entertain the ladies who come here to attend the convention. All the women are going to wear lavender badges with a ribbon of red, white, and blue. Like the badges the Kansas City men wear here, the badges of the Athenaeum women will contain the words, "Ask me anything you would like to know." I was so delighted to know that they actually instilled that into, you know, the female population, that they would actually know something that would help people. I tend to underestimate the past. The second one is a commentary on our streetcar system at the time. It is the custom in this town to start the last car from each terminus at 12 o'clock midnight. That this was the custom was not generally known, and when, at half past 11 o'clock last night, when it was still hotter than mustard and getting hotter, and growing, the people who did not have anything else to do but search for ways to keep cool took to the streetcars. The Honorable C.A. Walsh, Secretary of the Democratic National Committee, was one of the victims. Mr. Walsh got out on the end of one line that ends somewhere near Independence, Missouri. The conductor said when he got there, "We turn in here." "Thunder," said Mr. Walsh. "How am I going to get back to town?" "Don't know and care less," said the conductor cheerfully. Walsh got off and snapped back at the conductor, "Why didn't you tell me?" "I didn't know where you wanted to go," said the conductor. This is a quick one about the type of service that the attendees could find in Kansas City. They are very swift people out here in Kansas City. You can get almost anything done while you wait. The tailor shops and the hotels have this sign, "We fix you up while you eat or sleep." And on Walnut Street, there is a sign in front of a doctor's office, "We diagnose your case without asking questions." And finally, there's an interesting little comparison between New York, where all these came from, and Kansas City. How is it that we have not heard of this before? New York has a reputation for extreme wickedness, and we are painfully aware that we are none too good. But New York does refrain, nominally, and to some extent, really, from many forms of Sunday entertainment that Kansas City permits. And yet Kansas City does not get its name in the magazines. In some respects, it is a great advantage to be little, inconspicuous, and unimportant. How are we doing? We doing okay? One last little bit, I wasn't sure. Another theme that popped up while I was researching this is I kept saying the convention hall was the source of the phrase Kansas City spirit. And you tell me something like that, and I was like, I'm going to see if that's right. And I can tell you for sure that it was not, simply because there are newspaper references that use that phrase. But I think that phrase is really has always resonated in this town. It has come up and up again. And I wondered if it was more than just the general boosterism that you hear when there's a tragedy. I think back to when the Boston Marathon bombings happened and, you know, Boston Strong. And I mean, that's a wonderful thing. But I just was curious, was that all it was? Well, first of all, I found a speech by a gentleman named E.M. Clendening, who was the executive director of the commercial club at the time of this. And 3 years later, he's out in Indianapolis making a speech about how they did it. And the subject of civic pride comes up. Oh, here. Get this. Come on. "Unless you have realized that you owe something to the community in which you live, you cannot hope to make a success of the proposition which you are about to launch." I thought that really resonated with me, and I think it resonates with a lot of people I know. And then, of course, the event that the notion of Kansas spirit eventually got tied to was the 1951 flood, when Joyce Hall contacted Norman Rockwell, or the other way around, depending how you're reading it, about doing something that would commemorate the spirit of Kansas City for this event. And Joyce Hall said, "The Kansas City spirit is something to be found in good men's hearts that enables them to place service above self to accomplish the impossible." And I thought, that really speaks to me about the convention hall. Whether it's the right proper use of it for everything we associate that phrase with, I can't say. But I was happy to get that little bit of wisdom from this experience. And that's it. Thank you, Jeremy. Thank you, everybody. I'm happy to answer questions as I may be able to. Sharon.
Thank you. wondering where the Democrats were in 1900.
This was, that's a great question, and I learned so much about our political system, things that I hadn't known, that they talk about the party structuring in America in terms of the first party and the second party and the third party as we changed and moved from Whigs to Democrats, et cetera, et cetera. And this seems to be a pivotal point for that too, because a lot of the traditional Democratic, which now is thought of as Republican viewpoints, although I hesitate to use today as a reference point, I mean no disrespect, I'm just saying I think we're at a little more polar ends than they seem to have been at this point in time. Still, in all, those were generally juxtaposed. But as you can see, I mean, Teddy Roosevelt being a Republican is an excellent idea, but very shortly after this, that begins to switch. Kansas City, every time I've looked at the politics in relationship to an event, Kansas City seems to be better than a lot of places at saying, politics belong over here, let's get it done. And then we can squabble like politicians later, right? So I don't know that it would have made any difference, you know, if it had been in a different time. But you're right, it was, their roles were slightly different.
What do you know about controversy to tear down the second hall?
Oh, actually there wasn't much controversy about tearing down the second hall because it was a big building boom in Kansas City. It was that Art Deco. So it was the time where we were getting the new courthouse and the new city hall and lots of other buildings around town. So we were just in a big building boom and couldn't get out of, you know, we just couldn't have enough of it, I guess.
Was it publicly funded?
Publicly funded? No, it was entirely privately funded. And I'm glad you asked this question because this is really interesting. That it was part of the deal that it be for the people of Kansas City. So there was a legal organization that had no ownership rights. It just had managerial and stewardship rights of the funds. It never was in public hands. It wasn't in public hands until Municipal Auditorium was built. Charlotte.
I may have missed it, but what year was the second convention center?
Oh, it was built sometime between April 4th, when it burned down, 1900, and July 4th, 1900. Oh, the second one. Well, actually, that is the second one, but I know what you mean. Okay. The one that Maggie just talked about, it's the second one. Yeah, right. The second one was late 20s, early 30s, I think.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Elaine. Well, you mean this second one?
Did they try the first one? Did they try to hurry up and get the surrounding neighborhood ready at the same time?
No.
Or did they
just let it go? Yeah, well, it's somewhere between those two phrases because this was not an era where people felt the need to organize things that way. And there was no zoning and no land use law, so you could have all of those uses and a small factory next to it, and nobody would have thought a thing about it.
Mm-hmm. And the original building, it was not insured, was it?
Yes, it was insured. But they insured it wisely by getting, I think it was more than 20 different insurance companies, each carrying a part. So it was never a big catastrophe for any one insurance company to pay the liability insurance on it. Oh, it was, and it was absolutely up to code for what Kansas City required. Kansas City was just so far behind the industry standard that was the cause.
So the insurance company did not?
No, they paid it because the city, all the right people signed off on it.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Anything else?
Mm-hmm. We were close to losing the convention
to another city? There was certainly a lot of coverage about that. There have been a lot of competition beforehand, and I'll just throw that in on the road to answering your question, the other two major contenders were Chicago and Milwaukee. But one thing the Democrats were interested in doing was getting more labor support. And they had pretty much gotten everything they could out of those two cities. But they were had keyed on German populations. And so here was an unexploited German population in Kansas City. So that weighed so heavily, that decision, that they themselves were not very inclined to change. But that didn't stop a whole bunch of other cities, you know, putting their name in the hat in the newspaper. Happily, while St. Louis had originally tried to convince them on the first round of bids, they stood up front real quickly and said, we will come to Kansas City and give them anything we have to offer to make sure that they get to have the convention. I don't think they had to actually end up doing that, but it's very much to their credit. They probably, if anybody could have stolen it from them, it might have been St. Louis. Yes, sir. You know, that's a great question. I can't answer that specifically. I do know that from just sort of reading the accounts of this construction, that like most construction crews, it was people were piled on top of one another trying to do this and things would get backed up and whatnot. So I can't give you any real estimate, but it was impressive. But of course, the other thing is that we had a level of craftsmanship. So like you think of all those stonemasons, there were probably fewer stonemasons trying to do a really good job than we would put on the job today, right? Yes, sir.
Where did they take the degree to?
You know, that's a great question. I have no idea. I think they got the steel, they sold the steel for scrap, but the rest of it, I have no idea. Yes, sir. Oh, Jim. Oh, yeah, this is my one female contribution story that I really love. So there was a woman whose name escapes me right now, but she had a millinery shop. When the commercial club had their first meeting, you know, kind of get everybody excited, they went out of their way, I'm sure, to artificially say, the first check we got was from Mary, blah, 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 who owns this little millinery shop. Yay, Mary gave us $100. You know, yay, yay, yay. Ends up in the papers. It all sounds good. When they went through the design competition, they were looking for a place, once the design was chosen, that they could take all these designs and set them up, and people, the public, could come and see them. And the guy who owned the Studebaker dealership, which was not cars at that point, it was kind of still wagons and trucks and things, said, well, I've got this big showroom. You can do it here. And I'll let you do it here if, and he had a list of all these concessions and things he wanted. And the commercial club said, you know what? Let's put in Mary's millinery shop. And so, you know, good for her. I mean, just because she was the first one to give him $100. Maybe she made that other hat. She might have been the one. I don't know. Anything else? Okay, thank you all.